Well, welcome, listener. Yes, there's my eternal optimism shining through. A listener. I believe there's one. I'm not counting on any more than that, but I believe there is some poor soul out there who is so desperate and lonely would actually take the time to sit and listen to this drivel. So welcome, whoever you may be. And if perchance I can increase my listenership to two, if you've dragged a friend in, good on you. First of all, I must apologise if I sound a little out of sorts. I am in the recovery mode from a very nasty bout of flu. And I'm just taking a pause there. So if my listener happens to be female, she can get over the laughing and the usual, man flu. Well, let me say this. It wasn't bloody man flu. This was the full-blown knock-you-off-your-socks thing flu. It did me good and proper. And in order that I can clarify that, and just in case you doubt the veracity of my claim, consulting the Oracle, or Tinterweb, I put in my symptoms. 40-degree temperature, verified several times a day by wife and younger child, by sticking digital thermometer in my ear. Thankfully, it was my ear. And I was laying on my back at the time, because it could have been somewhere else, had they so chosen. 40-degree temperature, sweating like a politician in a polygraph. Sore throat, very sore throat, coughing, spluttering, aching limbs. Every joint felt like it had been beaten with a stick, without the fun part that goes with it, if you get my meaning. Where was I? See, even the mind's gone a bit addled because of it. High temperature, aching limbs, coughing, spluttering, a 36-hour sleep stint, which wasn't altogether unwelcome, but accompanied with somewhat dodgy dreams, which I can only put down to some kind of hallucinogenic that was either slipped to me, or because I was in a raging fever, allowed me to have some very strange, dark dreams. That may have been the case. I'm not sure. But I had them. There was also the chills, the chattering of the teeth, the shaking of the body. And punching all this information into the Tinterweb, I had indeed had full-blown flu. So it wasn't man flu. It was real. And even the wife, bless her, said to me, "You've got proper flu." Which, of course, was no real comfort, but it was nice to know that she didn't think I was a malingerer, that she actually recognised that I was ill. In fact, my malaise started at some point on Friday at work, the Friday gone. I was feeling somewhat uncomfortable. My back was aching. The throat was a little sore, and I was having the occasional splutter. And my head was beginning to ache. But I thought that was just down to the absolute rubbish I had to watch at work. And I just thought my brain was saying, I can't take any more of this drivel. I'm going to ache now. But it was, in fact, the early onset symptoms of flu. And when I left work and got on the train, all the way from jolly London back to Peterborough, by the time I said arrived to said city, I was feeling pretty yuck. And I got in and knew then that something was amiss, that I was about to be infested with something nasty. Now, I should say at this point, I'd promised to take the wife to Cambridge for her birthday, which sounds pretty poor when you say it like that. You know, it wasn't Saint-Tropez or Monte Carlo. It was actually to go shopping. There's a particular shop there that there isn't one near us, so we have to go there. And she wanted some particular garments from this shop, if you get what I mean. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was just Nice specialist. No, I can't say specialist, can I? Because that is even worse. She just basically wanted to go and find this stuff, and the only shop is in Cambridge. So we shot off, we were due to shoot off Saturday morning to said Cambridge. Obviously, seeing my poorly state, she did question the sense of where we should go. But being the stoic chap that I am, I insisted that we head out into the unknown early Saturday morning and do the promised shopping trip, which we did. And jolly good fun was had by all. But one has to admit, by 1 o'clock, I was prepared to lay down and let people pick my pockets because I just didn't care anymore. My back was aching. I felt absolutely dreadful. The smile every time I was asked, are you all right? Yes, I'm fine, dear. Don't worry about me. Was beginning to fail. I truly felt as if this was it. This was time to let go. Open the gates and Peter, I'm here. I felt that rough. It was really bad. Anyway, we did our shopping trip and the goodly wife saw that I wasn't particularly in a good state and suggested we curtail the shopping expedition. I should say, having bought everything we required and visited numerous phone shops and the Apple store for Jakey, because we can't go anywhere without visiting phone shops. And if there is, God, if there is an Apple store, we have to go pay homage. It's like going to church. He kind of stands outside to suck in the atmosphere, looks up at that big Apple sign, and then enters with all the reverence of a priest entering a cathedral. It's quite extraordinary. There was our day. And I have to say, by the time I got home, it wasn't a bad trip home. I managed to get home without crashing a car, bearing in mind I could barely see out of one eye because the crushing headache by now was really beginning to take its toll. And I was sweating like a politician in a polygraph. I got home, collapsed into the chair. Sustenance was brought before me in the shape of a burger, which tasted like cardboard, but I duly devoured it, feeling that is it starve a sick, start a cold, feed a fever? I can't remember. Anyway, yes, ate that, and then by the time the early evening came, I was done. That was it. Over and out. Time to retire to bed, which I did, and remained there pretty much until Monday morning, about 11:30. And during that time, sweated, felt like I was freezing to death, chattering teeth, shaking limbs, aching back, headache banging like John Bonham's bass drum. That's a little aside there for the rock people who have... Well, there's no one listening, is there? There's just the two of you, possibly, or the one. And if you know who John Bonham is, he was a famous drummer for a very, very famous rock band. So you get the kind of analogy I'm coming up with. Yes, and I spent sort of 36 hours in a dreamlike state. Very weird dreamlike state. It was almost like I'd taken some hallucinogenics because I was having some very weird images, which can only come with hallucinogenics or, I believe, the flu. Having pumped all that information into Tinterweb, as I've said, apparently weird dreams can accompany said affliction. But anyway, there you go. So my weekend was stolen from me. But I did want to sort of broach this subject of man flu. It's something that's now in popular parlance. You get cups saying I've survived man flu or I'm with him, he's got man flu. And it seems to, and I'm sorry to say this, and I know that there'll be hordes of them waiting outside with shovels and picks ready to burn me and flaming brands ready to burn me at the stake for talking such heresy. But I think man flu, in fact, I know man flu was purely invented by our female friends. And it has become a cast iron saying that everybody now uses. Should a man, any man, intone that he's feeling slightly poorly. He's got man flu, which, however you say it, is meant as a derogatory term. You have man flu. Oh, got man flu, have we? You know, that little nudge. Oh, he's got man flu. Where's your husband? Oh, he's at home. He's got man flu. You know, well, while I'm absolutely certain that there are malingerers among us who at the slightest sniffle retire to bed and expect to be waited on hand and foot by said wife or handmaiden to have their brow mopped and tea served and rubbed down with an oily rag on occasion, I'm sure that's very true. But what has happened is that anybody, be it a sniffle, or in fact, like myself, victims of the raging flu, the real flu, are tarred with the same brush. We all have man flu. And it is grossly unfair. Now, as I've said, I'm expecting to leave here. And when this gets out, I'm expecting hordes of, if they find out about it, of course. And I have to say, the wife does check these to make sure I'm not saying anything derogatory about her. It's kind of like a censorship, really. You know, she likes to check my work and then do judicious editing should I say something untoward. So this may not get past the censors. I don't know. Maybe I'll be brave enough just to publish and be damned. Just put it out there and then await. But of course, if anybody does hear this, they will gather their forces and be outside on the lawn with flaming brands ready to run me out of the town or the village because of the heresy I now speak. But I'm afraid, ladies, it is true. You tar us all with the same brush if we have sniffle or said full-blown flu. And it's slightly unfair. And here I go, digging a bigger hole. You know, dare I mention PMT, which, of course, afflicts everybody, man and woman and child. You see, I'm going to get shot. Oh, no, I'm going to get beaten censors for this. This is definitely not getting past the censors. I'm going to have to sneak this one out, I think, under the cover of darkness. I shall not tell her that I've podcast. I shall keep it a secret. And just let slip the dogs of war. Do you think? Possibly. What could be the repercussion? I mean, what could she possibly do to punish me? Actually, maybe I better run it past her anyway, just in case. But anyway, yes, dare I mention, I'm going to forge ahead. I'm a man of conviction, a man of little fear. You lying git. Yes, PMT. Now, if every time a woman threw a wobbly and we said, oh, PMT, love, we would be seen as somewhat sexist, and quite rightly so, somewhat unfeeling and sexist. But it is true, and I'm ducking my head when I say this, because I'm looking around furtively, just in case. It is true that when women have the plague of PMT, they can get a little temperamental. That is true. I think even the most diehard feminist would agree that they can get a little touchy with the old PMT. And because it has become a kind of cliched thing, and quite rightly so, has become politically incorrect to mention it, we no longer accuse women who are touchy of PMT. We just take the beatings and generally try to ignore it. And in these days of equality, I wonder why we men, us hunter-gatherers, are not afforded the same, what's the word, the same respect for when we come down with a malaise. Now, as I've said, I know there are malingerers amongst us. I have personal knowledge of several malingerers, who at the slightest hint of anything take to their bed and, oh, love, I'm so ill, could you get me a nice ham sandwich, you know, and that, oh, did my feet ache, could you give them a rub? And it's no wonder that the wifely person or the cohabitee, I've got to be careful because not everybody's married, of course, there are those that have escaped that. You know, the cohabitee, I can understand why they get a little knocked and a little frustrated. There's this, you know, generally useless article laying in bed, not half as ill as he's making out to be, demanding to be waited upon hand and foot. I can understand their frustration. But please, ladies, there are those amongst us who are genuinely ill sometimes. And in the pursuit of fairness, it would be nice if you would allow us to at least develop our symptoms and then make a judgment later on as to whether we are said malingerer or indeed suffering from the full-blown jobby. And if we are, it would be nice if, you know, occasional cup of tea was brought to the sick bed. You know, I don't expect a foot rub. I don't expect a rub of anything, personally. But you get my meaning. In fact, I'm too tired if this is what the flu is really like. And I have to say, I've had heavy, heavy colds before. But this was a doozy. So I'm assuming this was my first real bout of heavy, heavy flu. The last thing on your mind is being rubbed with anything or by anybody. Because I was in such a state of delirium, it wouldn't have mattered who it was. It could have been a 6'8" rugby player. I wouldn't have known. And quite frankly, I wouldn't have cared. If you allow us, if you don't mind, if you allow us the good grace to develop our symptoms, to see if it does indeed reach the required statistics, i.e. 40 degree temperature, give or take 1 degree either way, aching limbs, banging head, delirium, calling out for people who don't exist or you wish existed, as the case may be, long periods in bed, sweating, shivering. If that all happens, it would be nice if you kind of thought, well, okay, you know, he's got the flu. I'll stay the beatings this weekend. I won't have him climbing ladders and re-shingling the roof. Not in that state, because if he falls down, it's a hell of a mess, and I really can't be doing with that. If you afford us the same respect as we do now over your PMT, you know, it would be nice. Because having suffered recently, I have to say the dear lady wife was very kind. You know, she accepted that I had the flu, bundled me into the bedroom, locked the door, painted the red cross on the bedroom door, and forbade all visitors. I have since, when I told her the fever broke, she took me into the garden and decontaminated me with Febreze and a cold hose pipe and allowed me back into the house. So, you know, she did her bit and she accepted that I was, in fact, hopefully over the worst of it. I still feel, you know, the slight effects of it. I'm not 100% back to my jolly old self. But I do, you know, it is a plea that maybe if it happens to your loved one, or even the person you're living with and you don't like them, as may be the case, you know, have a little sympathy and lock them in the bedroom, paint the red door and leave them to fester and sweat on their own. But call it what it is. It's flu. It's not man flu. It's flu. Because if you get it, we don't call it woman flu. We call it flu. Yes, in the pursuit of justice, let's banish man flu from the vocabulary. Let's banish it completely. Let's call it flu, good and proper for everybody, and bring a new understanding to our lives as cohabitees, we can move forward. And I'm sure the world will be a lovelier place. Now I'm just going to take a short slurp of my drink, because as I said, the old throat still hasn't quite recovered. And I find that G&T, glycerin and something else, is very good for the throat. So I should just have a little little gargle to relieve the pain, and I'll be back. Right. Hello, I'm back. Time. Yes, time, the old master. That thing that rules our lives, the sort of that thing that we all feel we never have enough of, but at times we feel that it drags its heels. It's a strange old concept, time. And I know that Albert, bless him, Albert Einstein, said that time is relative, and of course it is. You know, if you think about it logically, it can't be anything else. If you can imagine being beaten with a stick for a whole 60 seconds can seem like a lifetime. I know exactly how that feels. She's not here, is she? No, good. Okay. Yes. Beaten with a stick for 60 seconds can seem like a lifetime. However, if you're only given 60 seconds to do something you thoroughly enjoy, it can seem it's gone in the blink. So I guess, yeah, the passage of time is something that is relative. And it's strange how, more so today, I think, time has become a bigger tyrant than it ever was. We've always been under the tyranny of time. And actually, if you think about it, it's a tyranny that we created. If you go back to, say, 3500 BC, in the time of the Egyptians, sundials were there. But they weren't counters of time in the way that we can understand it today. And in fact, even if you think about Stonehenge, they say that's like a big sundial, 2000 BC. It wasn't really until somewhere around the 1360s, that the first mechanical clock appeared. And then 15-something, the watches made their appearance. And I think with something that started to count time accurately and in such small divisions, i.e. seconds and minutes, that tyranny of time started to overtake us. We started to live by the minute, almost. I think before all that, there was a looseness to the way life was run. You know, you did things morning, afternoon and night and that sort of things. And a day had its usual pattern and flow. But I think certainly since the invention of the mechanical timepiece and the accuracy that it gives, we've become slaves to it. And we now, with things like, here I go, me old pet hate, mobile phones that have clocks on them so you can instantly see what time you are. Everything is about where you are, logging. Everything gets logged at what you do if you're on the internet or if you send an email or if you know, everything you do seems to have a time log. And it seems that we are more of a slave to time than we ever were. I know for myself, traveling to London every day, I am, a slave to the tyranny of time. I have to catch a train at a certain time in order to be somewhere by a certain time. And I have to catch a train home in order to be home at a certain time. Obviously, coming home isn't such a huge problem in terms of if I miss the train, I'm not going to get fired by the boss. I might get beaten by the boss when I get home, but you know what I mean. It's not sort of a... I'm not going to be savaged too much. Whereas going to work, you obviously have to be there on time and all that sort of thing. You can't keep walking and say, oh, do you know what? I missed the train and I thought, oh, well, shit, who cares? You know, I'll get the next one. Thanks for staying up for me, sort of thing. that doesn't happen. So you have to be. I feel that tyranny. You know, old Father Time sitting there saying, come on, you got to be here, you got to be there. That'll take this long, blah, blah, blah. And it's a hateful thing. And you can't really call it a modern malaise because, as I say, clocks were invented way back in 1360, sort of something like that. So I've often wondered what the driving force behind wanting to be able to tell time so accurately. I wondered what that driving force was, because I think before all that happened, and to a certain degree, even when the clock had been invented, it was, I should imagine, a very expensive piece of kit. So very few people had clocks. People tended to spend their day or live their day in a more natural way. Sunrise, sunset, and so on and so forth. And there seemed to be a natural order to the way the day went. And we've definitely lost all that. And it's just a case of modern living, I guess. And, you know, if you think about the world's worst enemy to anybody is the alarm. Set the alarm, you're woken from golden slumbers, the dream of a lifetime, and suddenly a rude awakening by a clanging bell. Although clucking bell is what I normally say when the alarm goes off, if you get my meaning. It's kind of, you know, we are tied to the clock. And the whole idea of time, like I say, it does fascinate me. I've read a few things about time and space and relativity and stuff, and I'm not a scientist in any way, shape or form, but if something piques my interest, I tend to find a little book somewhere and try and read up and make sense of it. And the whole thing with time and how it, you know, Einstein's theory that time moved at different paces, although time is constant, time moves at different paces depending on where you are and so on and so forth. It's all very fascinating, and it certainly screws with the head. But the leap on from that in terms of imagination is this whole idea of like time travel. And it's an interesting thing with time travel, because obviously people will say it's not possible. You can't go back to something, and you can't go forward to something that hasn't yet happened, as it were. You can't travel into the future. There's obviously this time continuum thing where if you're shot out to space for billions of light years and you come back, the relative time you travelled and distance to when you come back, it all changes. So you could leave at 25, get back when you're 30, but everybody else you know is aged by 40 or 50 years or something. There is this kind of strange equation that quantum scientists come up with. But, you know, whether you choose to believe it or not, or whether it's been proven, I don't know. But the whole question of time travel is a really tricky one, because we see films about time travel, and there's always this paradox. I need an echo for that. I'll have to put a little echo. Paradox. You know, where you can't meet yourself in the future, because you'll cause a paradox. And if you go back and you do something, you could change the course of the whole world. When I was at school, I distinctly remember a little story that was told us. I can't even remember what the book. It may well be a famous school book. I don't know. But for myself, I don't know. But it was basically about these time travel had been discovered. And they took these school children back to the dinosaurs. And they said to them, look, this specially constructed walkway has been developed. And you mustn't step off the walkway so as to not to disturb anything ever happening. You know, don't pick anything, don't touch anything, stick to the walkway. We can go there, observe, and then come back and nothing. And this particular group went there, and then they successfully did their visit, and then they came back. And when they came back to a completely changed world. And nobody could understand why, what had happened. Obviously, only the school party saw it as a changed world, because the other people who were in the changed world it was just their normal world. But for the school party, it was a completely changed world. And one of the school kids lifted his foot and looked at his shoe, and there was a butterfly on the bottom of his shoe. And somehow he admitted to having tripped and put one foot onto the soil and had somehow trod on a butterfly, which had then changed the course of the world's history. And, you know, there is this butterfly's wings flapping in Brazil, causing a tidal wave in Stoke-on-Trent sort of thing. And it's an interesting notion about the whole idea of time travel, because one of the things that films never broach, and this is something that I've been thinking about for a while with time travel films, one of the things they never broach is they never go back to some particular incidents in the past. You never really get a time travel film that goes back to biblical times. And I've often wondered about this, because surely if you were offered the chance to go back to a particular point in time, you're going to get the people who say, I want to go back and see West Ham win the cup final at such a, you know, you're going to get people like that, obviously. And you're going to get people who are going to want to go back to the assassination of Kennedy and so on and so forth, to see if they can discover whether it was the lone marksman in the grassy knoll and all that sort of thing. But I would think that if you had to choose just one trip back, the most major, supposed major event, apart from the destruction of the dinosaurs when the meteor hit and all that, you don't really want to go back then, because that could prove slightly tricky. A few singed eyebrows and so on and so forth. You don't really want to go back there. Well, I certainly wouldn't. I would think that most right-minded people would want to go back to see if this Jesus thing was real. Because let's face it, religion, whether you believe or you don't, it dominates everything we do. The whole idea of a God, the whole idea of Jesus being the Son of God, the birth of Christianity, blah, 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 Moses and the tablets and all. If you could go back to that particular point in time, you could say once and for all, yes, I was there, I saw him, it's all true. Or you could turn around and say, pack of lies, load of bullshit, let's move on. Let's abandon all this nonsense, get rid of religion, and let's move on. But in all the films about time travel, and there have been many, nobody ever goes back there. And I've often wondered why. Is it because if a director or a writer wrote the script, he or she would have to put in their own belief as a conclusion to the trip? And you open up a whole can of worms. Because if you say, well, this guy goes back in time and discovers the truth, you have to be putting the truth as you see it. So you would either be denying that it happened or confirming that it happened. And each is a bomb waiting to go off. So I can kind of understand why you wouldn't do it. But it is a tricky subject. It's something that very few films have ever touched. And certainly for me, as a complete non-believer, as somebody who is a complete atheist, I would want to go back to that time and see if it was true, see if any of this actually happened, or if indeed it did happen, but it wasn't the way it was written, or whatever, you know, just because it's such a huge thing, you know, in today's life. It, whether you are religious or not, it governs everything we do. And it would be amazing to be able to go back. Now, that leads me on to my next paradox. I've got to put an echo on that because that sounds like rubbish. So I'll inject maybe a bit of thingy afterwards. But anyway, one of the other things that films never kind of cover is that if time travel existed, why is it one person only ever goes back? Because surely if time travel was capable, we'd all be doing it. And we'd all be going back and changing everything. And the world would be in complete turmoil forever. Because I'd go back and think, I remember that really dodgy haircut I had and the embarrassment it caused me. I'm going back and changing that, make sure that never happens. So I whiz back, kaboom, make sure I don't get the haircut. And at the same time, somebody has also time travelled and said, yeah, do you know, I remember, same reason I'm here. I bought this shirt, ridiculed for months, not doing that, need to get that out of my memory. And you could have millions of people going back in time, changing all these really stupid little events. What would that do to the world? Could you imagine it? The world would never move on because you'd come back and you'd go, damn, I remember something else. Straight back in my time machine. Whoosh, let's go and change that. And what happens if you go back and cancel yourself out? So just supposing I didn't have that haircut, which quite frankly was embarrassing. I used to have quite long hair. I'm as bald as a badger now. I was hirsutely challenged by the time I was 26. And when I was younger, I did have lush long hair. It was rather wonderful. And one day, for no apparent reason, I decided that I wanted to fluff it up a bit. I wanted to have more hair. And a friend of mine, who wasn't, you know, a hairdresser, but had decent hair, he came in one day with this wonderful haircut. And I said, what have you done with your hair, darling? And he said that he'd had a demi-wave. And it sounded rather wonderful. And it looked, in fact, rather lovely and windswept and interesting. And I thought, that's the jobby for me. I'm having one of those. So I found out what hairdressing salon he'd been to. And duly booked an appointment over the telling bone to go and have my hair demi-waved. Now, the downside of this was that when I got there, I sat in the chair and I couldn't for the life of me remember what I'd ordered. So the young lady said to me, what do you want? And I said, oh, it's, you know, that thing that makes your hair kind of curly, you know, and windswept. Ah, I know, just the thing. And she gave me a frigging perm. And I looked like sort of a Frankenstein version of Brian May when I came out. In fact, I looked a bit like, do you remember, there was a programme a long time ago, Michael Benteen's Potty Time. Now, you're going to have to be of a certain age to understand this. But there was this, like, Michael Benteen, who was one of the original goons and was a really funny guy. He had this kind of little puppetry thing, and they were called potty men. And all they were, essentially, was a kind of mop-like hair with a nose, no eyes, no mouth, just a big nose sticking out. And then they would have various costumes on underneath. So all you had was this hair, a bit like that bird who sings now, Sia. She looks like a potty person, quite literally. But it was called Potty Time. Well, I came out looking like a permed Potty Time person. All you could see was my nose and this mass of hair, which was below shoulder length, in thick, dense, permed curls. I looked utterly ridiculous. I looked so ridiculous, in fact, that I had no time once, because this bloody thing took hours. So I had to go to work, and I was on night shift, thankfully. So I was sort of looked out the shop, made sure no one was looking, dived into the car, which was conveniently parked outside the salon in Winchmore Hill, I might add. I dived into the car, drove home, waited till the coast was clear, scarpered upstairs and sort of stuck a bag on my head. Because I knew there would be howls of derision and laughter from siblings. And then I had to face work, which was an absolute horrifying notion. And I went to work that night and I walked in, and within 30 seconds, the room that I worked in was awash with urine, where everybody had literally weed themselves laughing. Humiliation was just untold, apart from one person who came up and said they thought it was fantastic. And this was a guy we considered to be a complete weirdo and lunatic. He was the only one who came up and said, man, that hair looks so cool. But we knew he was a drug-addled hippie, ex-hippie, who was completely off his trollobob and, you know, thought potatoes were talking to him at times. He liked it, which compounded it even, it made it even worse. And I suffered three or four hours of unrelenting ridicule. So much, in fact, that I got home, barely slept, because the horrors were there. And first thing in the morning, I jumped out of bed into the car and I drove to this place in Camden Town, which I knew was a really good barber's because I had my hair cut previously there. And I rushed in and sort of dropped onto my knees and pleaded with this young Chinese guy who was the hairdresser, please get rid of this shit on my head. Do something with it. And after he'd picked himself up off the floor laughing, had taken several pictures and called people in off the street to have a look. I think what he was going to do was demonstrate how good he was, because this was a haircut beyond hell. And he felt that he could put it right. And if he could do that, he'd be the best hairdresser in the world. Remarkably, he did in fact do that. The hair was removed and I was left with actually quite a nice haircut, quite curly, a lot shorter than it had been. I'd lost the long bits, but I did look human. There was the potty time thing had gone, and, you know, or the bog brush, it had gone. Whoosh, that was the end of that. And, you know, it was a dark moment in my life. So I could probably go back and make sure that never happened. But you see, if we all kept going back, and supposing that I'd gone back and said, right, I'm not going to have that haircut done. I'm going back in time. And when that guy says to me it's a demi-wave, I'm either going to write it on my hand or write it on a piece of paper, or I'm just going to beat him to death for suggesting it because I knew what was coming. But if I went back and said, right, I'm not doing it, forget it, what would have happened? Who knows where my life would have led because of that? And that's the problem. If you go back and you alter the slightest thing, you don't know what's going to happen. And of course, it's not just dependent on you altering something. If you've got millions of people going back and altering stuff, it's odds on that someone you know somewhere is going to alter something that affects you. So we could be ping-ponging about all over the shop, never getting anywhere because everybody's rushing back in their time machine changing shit that they didn't like. So the time travel thing presents a huge problem in that respect. I personally don't believe time travel actually can be done. I don't think it does. Unless somebody comes along and opens up a wormhole in space and says, look, you can go from here to a billion light years in a blink of an eye, which in itself is time travel in that respect. I could understand that, but I can't imagine going through a wormhole and then coming back to the Earth in 1834 or something. I just can't see it. It's just something that I don't buy. Maybe futuristic in terms of zapping through a wormhole, which takes you a second to get 100 billion light years away and then a second to get back. And of course, by that time, the Earth has moved on 100 billion years or what. I don't know. I mean, it all gets so very complicated. It is an unlikely scenario. However, there is one aspect that I rather like, and it is in some way connected with music. There's a band called Eels, and the founder of the band is a man called E. And his dad, this is so weird, his dad was one of the original people who thought about multiverses, about within quantum theory and within quantum mechanics, the whole idea of multi-universes. And the basic nub of it is that for every decision we make, every decision that can be made is made. So if I decide to go left, at that moment in time, somebody goes right, somebody goes straight ahead, somebody goes back, somebody goes diagonally, whatever. Every possible outcome actually exists. So there are millions and millions of universes, my universes, with me doing all sorts of different things because I took a particular turn. I turned left in this one. I went straight ahead. I turned right. I went backwards. I stood and admired the flowers for a little bit longer. All of these possibilities exist, apparently, in multi-universes. And I kind of like that idea because it means somewhere, possibly, somebody didn't go through that haircut trauma. In fact, somebody didn't lose their hair because in another multiverse, maybe male pattern baldness wasn't part of their hereditary gene. So there could be a me somewhere whose dad didn't go bald. In fact, were known as hairy people. I nearly said hairy bastards then. Hairy people that just went on to have a very happy, hairy life because of something that their person did back in their multi-universes. And so you keep going back and back and back and back, and you have all these forward and forward and forward and all these multi-universes. And it's a brilliant notion. And for those of you or the person listening, if you haven't switched off by now, or if you've got a friend with you who's encouraging you to switch off, just as a bit of enlightenment, the whole process of this, the whole idea of this multiverses, really came about because of a thing called Schrödinger's cat. And it was a theoretical proposition put forward by Mr. Schrödinger. And no cats were harmed in this because it was theoretical. His idea was that if you put a cat in a box and you couldn't see in the box, and you put in the box a bowl of poison that, if it was knocked over, would emit fumes and kill the cat. If you put the cat in the box and locked the box and nobody could see it, okay, there are two possible outcomes. The cat is alive or the cat is dead. It is only by observation we can tell which one it is. But that doesn't mean that the other one doesn't exist, because at that point in time, both things exist. The cat could be dead, the cat could be alive. You can't knock on the box, by the way, and wait, meow, or something like that. You know, you can't do that. You can't touch the box. The box is completely sealed, no windows, you can't see in, you can't see out, nothing at all. Of course, the cat would suffocate, but that wasn't part of the theorem. If you get my meaning. Purely in a theoretical proposition, the cat is alive and dead at the same time, because both propositions, both possibilities exist side by side. And it was this that led to this whole idea of multiverses, which is incredibly fascinating. And it does open, you know, a world of possibilities for mischief. Because supposing you could cross these universes, supposing you could open a door, so you could be trundling along in your own universe and think, I've had enough of this. I'm going to see what he's doing next door. And you could open a door and go in and meet yourself in a different universe and say to that person, look, can you just pop over here a minute? I'll be back in a sec. Lock the door. So that poor sod's now got your misbegotten life that you've been leading, and you're in his, because you don't know for sure that his life is better. But for me, if he's got hair, I'll take the chance. So, whoosh bang, you're in there. Now, you could just keep crossing across. Oh, no, a couple of days here. No, I don't like his life. Let's cross over. And you could go to the next one and so on and so forth, because the others would then be trying it to come back, and you'd have all this crisscrossing. But it does leave the world open to a world of mischief that could be done. You could pop across, do something really nasty and come back again just to piss off the guy who's got hair. Think, right, well, I can't stay here because this isn't my world, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to piss him off by doing something. And, you know, that sort of thing. That appeals to the mischievous mind myself. But it is a fascinating little thing, this whole idea of time. And in fact, this thing about we never have enough time. I've often said it myself while wandering around, particularly in the summer, wandering around, excuse me, fates and festivals. Oh, dear. Cough up, it could be a gold watch. I've often wandered round fates and fun fairs and that and thinking, so many cakes, not enough time. Because I am a bit of a cake whore. I do like cakes. I have been known to linger suspiciously by the WI tent with all those homemade cakes and pastries. Because I am a bit of a sucker for the old cake. I've got to be honest. My head can be easily turned with a Victoria jam sandwich. You know, and if it's Black Forest Gatto, you got me. Do what you want. I don't care. Just let me eat spoonfuls of it and then you can do whatever you want. I am a sucker for cake. And if, perchance, they are serving freshly brewed tea with it, game over. I'm yours. I'll sell the children to you for whatever money. Just give me your cake and you can have the children. Do what you will with them. In fact, the goodly wife has often said to me, I guess you've been whoring over by the WI again, haven't you? Which is a terrible thing to say, but not far from the truth. You know, catch the lady's eye, bit of a wink. What a fine pair of macaroons they are, my love. And there's the thing, you see, if I could time travel, I could just keep going back to the fate. If I found a WI tent that was really good, with really good cakes, and let's face it, they're all really good, but if you found that real humdinger monster cake servings, I could just keep going back. I could eat my cake and have it. I could eat my cake and say to the missus, won't be a minute, literally, zoom, back. Ah, a slice of your jam sponge, please. Nosh it down, cup of tea, walk over to the goodly wife. I won't be a minute, psh, boof, straight back to the cake. And of course, if you're travelling back in time, I don't know if the cake that you've eaten would still be in you, because technically you haven't eaten it again. So you could just endlessly eat cake, go round eating cake forever. It'd be fantastic. I can't imagine a better life than drinking nice hot tea on a warm sunny day with a plethora of cakes to choose from. Sounds like heaven to me. But you see how small you can get. There are the greater things, going back and discovering if God exists. How the pyramids were built. Did in fact, you know, we do the things that we said in our history? Are they all true? No, I'm thinking of going back and having cake. So you can see the whole idea is flawed if it was left up to the masses, to the huddled masses, to the great unwashed. And that, of course, brings in the question, if time travel was possible, who would you send back? Who could you imagine would be trustworthy enough to send back? Well, you can scrub bankers, politicians, high court judges, pretty much anybody in the high levels of the police force. Who would you pick from? Who would you pick as your as the world's representative? If a man invented the one and only time machine and he said, right, we need a person to send back to trust them not to do anything that would benefit them, who would you send back? Because you know that in some way, whoever we sent back would pervert it. They'd be going back scribbling lottery numbers down. All right, yes, okay. I know what the lottery numbers were for those. I'll just whiz back then and I'll buy a ticket and then by the time I come back, I'll be a billionaire and all the rest of it because I'll have won it 10 times. You know, who do you send back who is trustworthy enough? And that in itself raises a big question, the honesty of the human race. Because if you could go back, the power you would hold would be immense. And there's that old saying, isn't there? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So would the world want to put its fate in the hand of a person that it possibly couldn't trust? I don't know. I don't know how it works. I'm not sure there's anybody I can think of off the bat who I would send back to observe, because the temptation to change things would be so huge, it's unbelievable. It's a tricky one. I have to say, if there is a year that I could go back to, just for the sake of it, And this is purely a personal thing. And it, once again, it's quite small. It's quite small-minded. If I could go back, I would like to go back to 1958, which is in fact the year that I was born. Not because I'd want to see myself born, but being a musician and a little bit of a car person as well, some of the greatest things in the world were invented in 1958. There was the great run of the Gibson Les Paul, 1958 to 1960, the fabled, you know, years of the magnificent Les Paul. But there was also the invention of the Gibson 335, the Flying V, the Firebird, and the Modern, which is a fabled guitar. And in 1958, Chevy brought out their 1958, appropriately named, Bel Air, which was a beautiful car. And I have owned one in my time. And it would be lovely to go back to 1958 and sort of find my dad and say to him, look, I know times are hard, but if you can invest in a couple of these guitars, they're going to be worth millions one day. Better still, I know your wife's pregnant. When she has the baby, keep the guitars for him, because he'll love you forever for it. And I could just imagine me old man looking at me, this strange person, dressed in strange garb. And it's, I could just imagine his face if this person said, look, your unborn child is going to be a guitar fanatic. Buy him these guitars, one of each. I know it's going to cost money, a lot of money, but it's well worth it, because when he's 20-odd, or when he's 14 and he starts playing, by the time he's 20, these guitars will be worth millions. I can imagine my old man going, absolutely no problem, I'll do that. Slamming the door in my face, calling up to me mum and saying, we need to buy these guitars. And as this child, when this child is born and grown up, don't ever let him near a guitar. Keep music out of the house. Don't encourage him in any way. And then we'll flog these damn things and we'll have the life of Riley. So you see, I could thwart myself by going back. But it'd be worth a try, I have to say, because you never know, that sparkling 1959 Les Paul, worth millions now, could be mine. Ah, the very thought of it makes me shiver. I'm off to invent a time machine. See you next time. Or not, before next time, or after next time, or even during next time. Sayonara. Bye.